Hello. In the last lecture, we looked at the Olmecs, who were the earliest major culture in Mesoamerica. Now, let's consider their counterparts in South America. Beginning around 2000 BC, people living in northwestern Peru began to produce ceramic pottery, and over the next millennium, ceremonial urban centers with monumental structures began to appear. The common feature of all of these sites was massive earthen and brick terraced platforms. And these were always arranged around three sides of a courtyard to form a distinctive U shape. And often across the base of the U, there would be erected a pyramid-like structure. Most scholars have interpreted this that the U shape reflects core cosmological beliefs regarding the very nature of the universe to these people. And the standard interpretation is that the opposing sides of the U represent the opposing yet complementary forces of the universe, and that the crossbar of the U, where that main pyramid is usually located, symbolically represents a fusion or an integration of those cosmically opposed forces. And this kind of dualism, combined with a synthesis, underlies many of the myths of the better-known later civilizations that will emerge from the same region. Overall, there are about 20 sites with these U-shaped structures that have at least so far been identified. And some of the more famous ones include Garagay, Huaca La Florida, and Cerro Sachin. The most influential early Peruvian culture, which is just about contemporaneous with the Olmecs, it also emerged around 1200 BC, and it would last until around 300 BC, is known as Chavin culture. And this name comes from the most famous site, Chavin de Huantar, which was founded about 900 BC in the highlands of the Andes. Chavin de Huantar is located at a strategic transportation node, as so many early cities were. It's near some mountain passes, but it also has good access down to the coast. And so this obviously reflects that lively trade, as well as the interdependence between the highlands and the coastal regions. Various domesticated animals, including guinea pigs, which is a key food source, and the llama and the alpaca, their remains have been found there, and the two large animals were used to carry loads as well as to supply wool for clothing. At its height, this complex probably housed maybe about 3,000 people. And Chavin de Huantar has one of those stereotypical U-shaped complexes, and its structures rise up to nearly 50 feet in height, and the base of the U there is about 150 feet long. Now, along the stone walls of that inner enclosure are a series of larger-than-life-size sculpted humanoid heads. And these heads have snouts of animals and fangs. And in the center is a recessed circular plaza. And the sides of that are also lined with relief sculptures of jaguars and various mythical creatures. Some of these are shown holding a staff, and they might have human bodies, but their faces, they have fangs, and at the ends of their limbs, they have clawed hands and feet. So they're odd sorts of animal-human hybrids. And these kinds of creatures are very commonly found in Chavin art. Many have speculated that the supreme deity, as he's shown on a number of stone slabs, was such a creature, with a more or less human body and also wearing human clothing, but with clawed hands and feet and with a more sort of feline or cat-like face with those distinctive protuberant fangs. The term Chavin really reflects more of an artistic style and a set of common religious beliefs that are shared among a number of sites rather than being a distinct culture or a single political unit. And while some of the subsequent Andean civilizations might be more famous, nearly all of them are thought to have been heavily influenced by this early Chavin culture. The best known of those later civilizations is, of course, the Inca, but they are relative latecomers to the scene. They don't form their great empire until around 1400 AD, so that places them well beyond the endpoint of this course. But between the Chavin and the Inca were dozens of other cultures, most of whom shared a very similar architecture, lifestyle, and religious beliefs. And while there's not time to cover all of those, I do want to look at one representative example of these cultures in a little bit more depth. And this is a civilization known as the Moche. Archaeologists spend a lot of time looking at clay pots. And maybe the main reason for this is that once clay is fired, it lasts forever unless it's repeatedly broken and ground into dust. So ceramic pots last longer than almost any other type of cultural artifact. Wood will rot away fairly quickly, even metal corrodes, but fired clay endures. And from very early on, almost every culture mastered the basic techniques of fashioning clay plates and vessels, and some of them included even learning how to throw them on a potter's wheel and to use glazes to make them both waterproof and to simply look attractive. The next logical step was to render these functional objects aesthetically pleasing by casting them into complex shapes and by decorating them with painted designs. In a professional career as an ancient historian and archaeologist, I've spent a great deal of time looking at lots and lots of different clay pots from very many different civilizations. And while this is important, of course, to understanding culture, quite honestly, it's often not the most, let's say, exciting aspect of being an archaeologist. But of all those many pots, those from one culture are my absolute favorites. And these are the pots made by the Moche people of ancient Peru. Many Moche pots have a creative, even sort of playful streak that makes them especially fun to study. Moche culture, which was based around a series of valleys high up in Peru, flourished between 100 and 800 AD. And they took advantage of the rivers that were flowing through those valleys to construct elaborate irrigation canals and to cultivate the usual crops such as corn, beans, squash, peppers, and avocados. Because of where they were positioned, they also had access to the sea. And so the sea provided them with an abundant source of other types of food, fish, crabs, crayfish, and mollusks. And in addition, they had llamas, guinea pigs, and ducks as animals that they raised as food sources. All of this together made them fairly wealthy. So the Moche were able to develop a dense urban culture, and this also meant that they had the spare time to build monumental architecture and to achieve high levels of sophistication in handcrafted objects. The Huaca del Sol is a pyramid-like temple building which is made up of an estimated 130 million adobe bricks. And that makes it the largest indigenous clay structure in all of the Americas. And as we'll see, when discussing the grave goods in the tomb of the Lord of Sipan, Moche goldsmiths and metal workers were extremely skilled. As impressive as those achievements are, it's the Moche pots that are most famous. Moche potters created an amazing variety of ceramic vessels that illustrate and bring to life almost every aspect of their culture. Moche pots are almost always decorated with fine line paintings that will show people, animals, plants, supernatural beings, and gods. Sometimes the pots will show scenes from everyday life. You'll see scenes of farming, hunting, fishing, other just sort of basic economic activities. The pots will graphically depict people both making war and making love. And it's not only the paintings on the pots that offer interesting visual images. Sometimes it's the pot itself. Moche potters would often form their vessels into the shape of birds, animals, monsters, creatures, or inanimate objects. So some pots are cast as portrait busts of the heads and faces of real individuals. And these might have almost as much detail as the famously realistic Roman portrait busts. Some pots will combine painting with low-relief molding of the pot surface. The standard Moche pot is a very distinctive design, and it's something called a stirrup spout bottle. And what it consists of is a roundish vessel from which two hollow tubes form an upward arc that comes together. And where those two tubes meet at the top of the arc, they fuse together, and then there's a little vertical spout with an opening at the top. And this so-called stirrup spout bottle is very common in South American cultures. And it's shown in ancient art being carried sometimes in a person's hand, using that actual little arch as a handle, or sometimes they'll have it slung over their shoulder with a strap passed through that arch. And in its basic form, the main vessel of this is just a spherical shape with a kind of flattened bottom on which the pot can rest. But in the more elaborate versions, the vessel itself is molded or cast into the form of a creature or an object, or sometimes even multiple figures. Some of the most memorable Moche pots that I've seen include ones that are actually cast in the shape of a winsome little fox sitting back on its haunches, or a merchant mounted atop a llama, or a multi-lobed squash or gourd. There's one I've seen that's very nice that's a kind of smug-looking parrot with its wings folded back. There's a whole set of them which show amorous couples engaged in sex. Another one shows a fat little frog who's inflating his throat sack. Some are just bundles of peppers. One is a very realistic-looking ferocious jaguar rearing up and clawing at the air. And one particularly complex pot shows a helmeted warrior bludgeoning his foe with a mace, and a final one is a really bizarre monster that has the head and arms of a human being, but the carapace and the six legs of a crab. Some of these Moche pots really seem to have just been crafted in order to show off the potter's dexterity and creativity. So there are some that have spouts within the spout. There's others that have a circular internal chamber within the main vessel. And there's even little windows carved in the outer layer that let you look right through the pot, so it's a kind of optical illusion. And one especially clever one that I've seen suspends the chamber that actually holds liquid inside an outer shell. And that outer shell has a bunch of little windows in it, and in those windows, the sculptor has placed little three-dimensional human faces, which are sort of peering inquisitively out of these windows. Even the pots whose main vessels are just the standard oval can have astonishingly complex images painted upon them. So one scene that you see on a whole bunch of these pots is a row of realistically portrayed warriors dressed in this complex segmented body armor with helmets that have high crests on them. And they're carrying all kinds of different weapons, most typically spears, maces, or axes. And sometimes these warriors will be shown fighting one another and actually crushing their opponent's skulls and then stripping off their armor to take home as a trophy. Other times the warriors simply march past in ranks. We also see scenes of temple rituals. Sometimes you'll see people who are obviously elites, maybe kings, priests, somebody like that, being carried in litters. And one especially odd category of figure in all these illustrations are strange, monstrous beings that again mingle together elements of humans and animals. Some examples of these include men who are shown with the heads of hummingbirds. Others are sort of unidentifiable things with the bodies and limbs of crayfish, but human heads perched on top. You'll see hybrid owl men, fox men, lizard men, centipede men, snake men, and even one remarkable creature that seems to be a cross between a person and a sea urchin. On another pot, you see a thing with the torso and legs of a human being, but also eight octopus tentacles sprouting from its back, and two giant eyes on its chest, and it's actually steering a fishing boat. While these sort of mutant monsters might strike us as frightening, Moche pot designs often seem to have a very playful sense of humor. And one of the areas that you see this is they'll sometimes anthropomorphize normally inanimate objects. So one pot shows a little army of plates, jars, and containers who are helpfully marching around on little legs, bringing food to tables, and pouring out drink for themselves into a row of cups, while a human in the background watches the whole thing with an approving expression. Another shows a chaotic array of different household objects, spindles, clothing, all kinds of things, sprouting limbs and running about the house. And finally, one pot has an enterprising warrior's helmet, which has grown arms and legs, and seemingly on its own initiative, has gone out, captured and subdued an enemy warrior, and is now actually sacrificing him to the gods. Of all of these animated objects, my personal favorite, in terms of category of decoration, and this is something that appears on a number of surviving pots, shows little humble beans. But they're not just beans. These beans have grown human arms and legs, they've put on armor, and they're shown engaging in combat. And this genre of decoration are known as bean warrior pots. And they come in all kinds of forms, and they depict a whole range of exploits of these little militant legumes. And maybe the most bizarre scene is one that shows several very well-equipped bean warriors fighting a fierce battle against a group of large-eyed creatures that are some sort of cross between a deer and a human being. In 1987, one of the more spectacular South American archaeological discoveries was made when a tomb was found of a high-ranking Moche man. This tomb was labeled the Lord of Sipan, and the person buried there was estimated to have been about 40 years old at the time of his death. And he was obviously someone of high status because he was buried with a huge array of expensive grave goods, including lots of fine gold, silver, and copper metalwork. He was also buried with ornate headdresses and pectorals, these sort of chest pieces. There are also in there little ear ornaments, which are inlaid with turquoise. There were also a number of seashells and, of course, over 1,000 ceramic pottery items. Six other individuals were buried around the main figure, as well as a dog and a couple of llamas. And found nearby to this tomb were two other tombs, one of which had a man who's been identified as a priest, and another that genetic analysis revealed seems to have been an older relative of the Lord of Sipan. Maybe he was even the previous Lord of Sipan. Just as there was a proliferation of cultures that followed the Chavin and that were influenced by them, when we turn our attention northward to Mesoamerica, we find lots of different cultures who sort of followed in the footsteps of the Olmecs, and who shared a number of fundamental cultural similarities with them. Some of those include cultures such as the Zapotecs, the Nayarite, and the Azapa. The Mesoamerican archaeological site of this era that most stands out, though, for the sheer, huge scale of its monuments, is a place called Teotihuacan. This is located just about 30 miles northeast of Mexico City. And the ancient city of Teotihuacan is probably one of the most visited tourist sites in Mexico today. So you can go there and you can explore the remains of what was once a truly gigantic city. It stretched 3.5 miles in one direction and 2 miles in the other, and it contained at least 5,000 structures. At its zenith, which is thought to be around 500 AD, Teotihuacan had an estimated population of maybe between 125 and 200,000 people, which would have made it one of the biggest cities in the entire world at that time, and almost certainly the largest city yet seen in the Americas. Teotihuacan has these very, very large main avenues that run through the city, and the whole thing is laid out on a grid plan, so it's positioned along north-south and east-west axes. Teotihuacan is dominated by two massive stone pyramids, and we don't know what gods these are actually to, but they've been labeled by later archaeologists the Pyramid of the Sun and the Pyramid of the Moon. And at over 200 feet high and 600 feet wide at its base, the Pyramid of the Sun occupies just about the same footprint as Egypt's Great Pyramid of Cheops. Although, because the Pyramid of the Sun has somewhat squatter proportions, it's shorter than the Egyptian pyramid. There are broad staircases which lead up to the summits of both pyramids, and at the top there were clearly temples where various rites and sacrifices to honor the gods were performed. Unlike the pyramids in Egypt, tourists can climb to the top of the pyramids of Teotihuacan, and from up there you can survey the surrounding city from a very nice lofty perch. And it's a view that I can attest from personal experience is a spectacular one. The main street at Teotihuacan has been labeled the Avenue of the Dead, and it nicely connects the three main monuments of the site. So it begins in the north, the Pyramid of the Moon. It runs south for over a mile to a complex called the Temple of Quetzalcoatl, and along the way it passes by the other big pyramid, the Pyramid of the Sun. Now, the Temple of Quetzalcoatl is one part of a larger complex, but its most prominent feature is a six-tiered step pyramid. And the vertical faces of each level of that pyramid are decorated with huge carved protruding stone statues of heads. And half of these heads depict the god Quetzalcoatl. And this is in his manifestation as a feathered serpent. So it's a snake head with a ring of feathers around it. And by the way, that's the literal meaning of the word Quetzalcoatl. Quetzal is the feathers of the Quetzal bird. Coatl means snake. And these heads alternate with the head of another god who has fangs and sort of big, protuberant, round eyes. And these are thought to be representations of the water god, Tlaloc, although some people have started to question that identification. And the whole surface of the structure, including the heads, originally was painted in bright, bright shades of blue, white, and green. The largest stone statue found in Mesoamerica is a 168-ton colossus that traditionally has been thought to represent the rain god Tlaloc and to be associated with Teotihuacano culture. And for years, this particular statue lay abandoned on its back in a brush-filled gully in the modern little village of Cuatlinchan. That's about 30 miles outside of Mexico City. My family is actually from Mexico, and when my father was a young boy, he and his schoolmates would climb on top of this giant Tlaloc statue, and they would play around on top of it and sometimes eat picnics on top of it. Finally, in 1964, archaeologists took away this huge colossal statue using a specially built flatbed truck. And today, the Cuatlinchan Tlaloc stands upright right outside the main entrance of the National Museum of Anthropology in Mexico City. Excavations at Teotihuacan have also revealed a number of burials, including at least 200 which are in and around the Temple of Quetzalcoatl complex alone. And because of their position, these are usually interpreted as being sacrifices to the gods. There's also evidence of large marketplaces. So that gives us some sense of the scale of trade in both local and imported products. And trace remains tell us that some of the luxury goods which were imported include cacao, shells, rubber, and decorative feathers, as well as all kinds of foodstuffs. Certain areas of the city seem to have been occupied by groups of craftspeople who shared a specialization. So, for example, all the workers who made jade objects could be found in one zone of the city. And archaeologists have also found a nearby obsidian mine, which might have played a role in the choice of the city's location. And obsidian, that shiny black stone, was not only held precious throughout Mesoamerica as a favored material for things like art objects and tools and mirrors, but it was also the substance used to make weapons and sacrificial knife blades. The basic architectural style of Teotihuacan, which you can see both in the monumental ceremonial buildings, but also just the ordinary humble residential or commercial structures, is something that's been called the Tallid Tablero style of architecture. And in this style, buildings are constructed by beginning with a layer that has a sloped outward face, and this is called the talud. And then on top of that is placed another layer which has a vertical outward face, and that's the tablero. Then that's followed by another slope section, another vertical one, and so on. So you get alternating layers of the sloped and the vertical, and that's the talud tablero style of architecture. Judging from the surviving art, sculptures, murals, and buildings, the religion that was practiced by the Teotihuacanos clearly shared some common elements, at least in terms of the iconography of the gods and the performance of certain rituals, with other Mesoamerican civilizations that came both before and after them. For all the richness and scale of the archaeological remains at Teotihuacan, there are a lot of fundamental things that we don't know about that civilization. And not least of these is the identity of the people who built this huge city. The name Teotihuacan was given to that site by the much, much later Aztecs. And all it does is it translates to something like the place of the gods. So again, we don't know what the real name of this place was or what the people who built it called themselves. The earliest structures there have been dated to around 200 BC, and the city seemed to have reached a peak around 200 to 500 AD, and then gone into some sort of decline. There is some evidence, in at least parts of Teotihuacan, that seems like some of those buildings were burnt down. But again, whether that was by invaders or some sort of internal tension, nobody really knows. But what archaeology can tell us is that by about 800 AD, the city seems to have been completely abandoned. As for the people, the Teotihuacanos themselves, who they were is uncertain. Various scholars have tried to construct arguments identifying them as belonging to, or at least being linked to, various other cultural groups in Mesoamerica. Arguments have been made trying to tie them to the Olmec, the Zapotec, the Maya, the Toltec, the Totonac, or the Nahua. But many people now believe that the inhabitants of Teotihuacan were maybe influenced by several or all of those different groups. So perhaps they were a mixture of different ethnicities. And as we've seen over and over again in this course, when all that survives from a site or culture is physical archaeological evidence, it's very hard to reach firm conclusions, even about basic issues such as these. Mesoamerica also had its share of potters, who made creative, beautiful, and even entertaining ceramic vessels. And perhaps one area whose potters might be compared to those of the Moche is the region encompassed by the modern Mexican state of Colima. And from around 300 BC to 300 AD, the ancient potters of the Colima region, which is in central Mexico along the Pacific coast, produced a very distinctive style of ceramic vessel. Like some of their Andean counterparts, Colima pots are famous for being cast in the shapes of animals and objects. And these Colima pots don't have that whole complicated stirrup-spout arrangement that we saw in Moche vessels, but instead they just have a simple opening, or one spout at the top. And some of these shapes that these pots took are realistically rendered parrots, cacti, gourds, ducks, and fish. Sometimes you see humans, including flute-playing musicians. And a little bit oddly, there's a number of pots in the form of hunchbacks and dwarves. But the most standard Colima-style vessel, by far, is in the shape of a plump little dog. And these are often sculpted with a great deal of personality, with the pups sometimes looking like they're smiling. Or sometimes you even have two dogs standing upright, resting their paws on one another's shoulders, as if they're in a kind of a dancing posture. And these particular pots have been identified as depicting this specific breed of small hairless dog, which is found in Mexico, and is called the Xolotzitzcuintli. And while the dog pots are certainly cute, and this factor has made replicas of them a very lucrative item to sell to tourists, there is a darker side to these appealing little sculptures. Unfortunately, the plumpness of these dogs is almost certainly due to the fact that they were being fattened up in order to be eaten by humans. As I mentioned, Mesoamerica lacked large domesticated animals, so that the Xolotzitzcuintli dogs were an important source of meat. In contrast to the multicolored paintings found on Moche pottery, Colima pots are almost always unpainted, and they just have a simple glaze, which is used to kind of bring out the natural colors of the reddish-orange clay that they're sculpted in. In the next lecture, we'll look at our final and maybe the most sophisticated Mesoamerican culture, the Maya. Thank you.